I'm Howard Bryant, and this is Only a Game. Growing up in Boston, every sports-loving kid wanted to be Bobby Orr, the legendary defenseman for the Boston Bruins. It didn't matter what neighborhood you were from or what color you were, and probably if you were a boy or a girl. He was that big. So it didn't surprise me at all that as a little girl, the legendary U.S. soccer goaltender Brianna Scurry idolized Jim Craig, the hero of the 1980 U.S. Olympic hockey team. Here's reporter Olivia Christian.
I didn't grow up a huge soccer fan. I played basketball and tennis, sports that had their stars' faces on Wheaties boxes and on the cover of Sports Illustrated.
The question everyone has been asking lately, why has America become so enthralled with this Women's World Cup?
But in 1999, like millions of others around the world, I became a fan. That was the year the U.S. women's national soccer team won their first World Cup. The breakout star was Brandi Chastain, alumnus of Santa Clara University, the school that I was attending at the time, the school that celebrated its star by blanketing the campus with T-shirts and signs with her name and likeness. Brandi scored the last penalty kick, and after doing so, took off her jersey, dropped to her knees, and pumped her fists in jubilation. While the country was celebrating her as our new national treasure, I wanted Brianna Scurry, the goalkeeper, the one who made the save that gave us the 5-4 victory over China, to be as exalted. For years, I've wondered if Brianna were a blonde white woman that showed us her sports bra when she made that save, would her career, her life, have been different? A few weeks ago, I finally had the chance to ask Brianna Scurry what she thought of that moment.
That was vintage Brandi. Her taking off her shirt truly was like the deserving image of what we had achieved and accomplished. And it was just as it should be.
This was not the answer I was expecting. To really understand Brianna's perspective on this, we need to go back to one of her earliest sports memories, the one that made her think, oh, this is awesome. I want to do that.
When I was 8 years old, I remember sitting on the couch with my mom and dad watching the Miracle on Ice unfold before our eyes. And when the USA beat the Soviet Union in that semifinal, and Jim Craig, the goalkeeper at the time, was just absolutely amazing. That team won that game greatly because of him. And that's what I wanted. I wanted to be a gold medalist.
Well, thinking about it now, do you find it curious that 8-year-old Brianna was looking at an older white man in hockey and thinking, I want to be like him?
You know, it didn't occur to me that it was odd.
Brianna grew up playing lots of different sports, including tackle football. At 12 years old, she found the game of soccer. From the beginning, she was a goalkeeper.
I'm from a very small rural town in Minnesota, and so they didn't have a girls' team at the time, and the coach thought it was a good idea that the girl playing goal, they thought it would be the safe place for the only girl on the team to play. As we all know, it's the most dangerous position there is, but I loved it.
After a successful collegiate career at the University of Massachusetts, Brianna received an invite to join the U.S. national team. This was the team, the one that broke women's soccer wide open in this country.
I remember my first training camp as absolutely brutal. I mean, Michelle Akers was there, Karen Gabera, Julie Foudy, Mia Hamm, all these players that were absolutely elite, the best of the best, and not just in this country, but in the world. And so it was a very humbling experience for me, digging the ball out of the back of the net no less than 1,000 times, I'm sure.
Well, looking back at that early team, thinking about your teammates, how do you think they would describe you?
They would say I am intense. I think intense, fearless, occasionally very demanding. I mean, I think over time they grew to love me, and I hope that's true.
That team played for the gold medal at the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta, in front of tens of thousands of people in the stadium rooting for the home team and millions watching around the world. This was the moment Brianna had been dreaming of since she was 8.
It was magical. You know, millions of things had to occur in order for me to get in that exact spot at that exact time. And I was there, so I just knew we were going to win. It was just a matter of time. I just needed to focus in and do my job. And I had complete faith that everybody else would do theirs. And they did.
In that moment, Brianna and the other women who now own gold medals became heroes for the next generation of soccer players. Over the next year, the nation watched, thanks to television commercials, as Brianna, Brandy, Mia, Tiffany, and Tisha went to great lengths to stick together. Whether it was third, fourth, fifth, and sixth wheeling it on a date.
I'll call you guys.
Or taking a team trip to the dentist.
He had to drill. I got two fillings.
The team did everything together, at least on TV.
Then I will have two fillings.
But Mia, I just examined your teeth. They're perfect.
I will have two fillings.
No longer did 8-year-old girls have to look to men as their role models.
And I think that was one of the things that was so appealing about our team. You could find someone that looks a little bit like you, who runs a little bit like you, who seems that they could be your big sister. It was truly amazing just watching soccer explode in this country. But it wasn't just soccer that exploded, in my opinion. I think it was powerful women in general.
And that brings us back to that 1999 World Cup. The tie, the penalty kicks, and Brianna's save.
The shot! Save! Scoring!
I'm not much older than Brianna. Most of my sports role models growing up were dudes. So when she made that amazing save and stomped her feet, threw her head back, and roared in that 1999 World Cup, I thought, finally, an African-American woman on the world stage, literally saving us. For me, that was the image that should have been celebrated by a grateful nation, but not for Brianna.
For me, if Brandy doesn't take that last kick, I think women's soccer is still super popular, but not anywhere near the way it ended up rolling out. Because what her image showed is a literal transformation of an opinion of women from one way to another way. That it was cool to have muscles and to be fit and to be strong. So in that regard, for the greater good of the game, her image would go a lot further for a lot longer than mine would have gone.
Brianna did receive a few endorsement deals. She made it on that Wheaties box, and she sat on the couches of Jay Leno, Rosie O'Donnell, and Regis and Kathy Lee. After several more years as part of the U.S. national team, Brianna went on to play professionally. In 2010, as a member of the Washington Freedom, things changed.
I got hit in the side of my head on making a low ball save. For the few weeks and months after that, it just wasn't getting better. It was getting worse. And it was a very tumultuous time for me. I was 38 years old and I was considering retiring anyway soon, but not as abruptly as that, obviously. And part of the reason why I think that I didn't pursue a lot of opportunities back then is because in my mind, I wasn't capable.
For years, I assumed the lack of Brianna on my television, calling games and giving commentary was because she was Black. I thought it wasn't enough that she made that incredible save. Her look wasn't the look that America was ready to celebrate. In reality, it was the sport that gave her so much, that was now responsible for taking so much away.
I just couldn't keep my thoughts together. I suffered, you know, intense headaches every day. I had, you know, vision issues. I honestly felt like I couldn't learn anything new for a while because I couldn't make it stick and then I couldn't recall it. You know, then the emotional stuff started to happen, like anxiety and depression and, you know, panic attacks and things like that. And so basically everything that I had planned on, you know, doing just went into a hole. That year after 2011, I was actually doing ESPN broadcasting for that 2011 World Cup. Mm-hmm. And struggled every single day. We were in Germany for 30 days, and every evening I would go to my hotel room and cry. And cry and cry every day because I couldn't make anything stick. My performance on screen and on air wasn't very good, in my opinion. I mean, I couldn't remember the things I had said and, you know, all these kinds of things that you deal with when you have concussion symptoms long term. And, you know, after that time, I just basically disappeared.
Brianna disappeared into a studio apartment in New Jersey and into the chaos of trying to receive treatment for the side effects of her career-ending concussion. but I was surprised when she told me that she wouldn't change a thing.
I met my current wife. I would never have met Krissa without it. And, you know, now, and I think back on it, it was actually something that changed the path of my life in a good way. I mean, I'm as happy as I've ever been in my life. And this is going to last until I'm 90 or whatever, I hope. And it's something that at the time I couldn't have seen, you know, but it was just the path I was meant to walk.
These days, Brianna walks the sideline as an assistant coach for the Washington Spirit and the hallways of colleges and conferences, talking with audiences of all ages about diversity, perseverance, and the dangers and symptoms related to concussions.
I'm 46 years old, and it's been 20 years since I first started playing on the national team and everything. And now seeing the team that plays for the USA now, all of those girls saw us do what we did. So many people go through their lives and they affect in a positive way, you know, a handful of people. And I know that my life and what I've done in it has positively impacted millions. And I know that.
Yeah.
I mean, the ripple effect of that, how we were able to impact an entire world by showing strength, showing power, by showing that it's okay to be strong, it's okay to sweat. I mean, I love my medals. I love, you know, my accolades, don't get me wrong. But I tell you what, when I have little kids come up to me who are, you know, my mom thinks you're great. You know, it's like, you know what? I think that's pretty cool. I mean, how many people can say that?
I'm a little embarrassed about the story I made up in my mind about what happened to Brianna Scurry after the 1999 World Cup. My own experience as a young Black athlete, playing on teams and in clubs that were majority white, for coaches that seemed to hate my being there, led me to fill in the gaps of her story. Coupled with that embarrassment, though, is a sense of relief. I'm relieved to know that I was wrong. Brianna is an even bigger hero than I thought she should have been.
That was reporter Olivia Christian. Women like sports, so why doesn't sports talk radio do more to attract female listeners?
They have the audience they have, they know they're engaged, they know they buy things, and they seem okay with that.
That story's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
This message comes from Only a Game sponsor, Samuel Adams. Of all the beers Sam Adams has ever brewed, Boston Lager is their all-time favorite. With its distinctive balance of spicy hops, sweet roasted malts, and smooth finish, it stood the test of time and helped launch the whole craft beer revolution. Sam Adams Boston Lager. Full-flavored, rich, and complex. There's nothing quite like the taste of an original. Boston Beer Company, Boston, Mass. Savor responsibly.
I'm Howard Bryant. It's time for three stories you should know. This week, we're going to start with football, you know, soccer, the sport of kings, and then move on to the NFL. I'm joined by SB Nation's Tyler Tynes, whose work is featured in the 2018 Best American Sports Writing. In bookstores this week, welcome back and congratulations, Tyler.
Thank you.
And by one of my very favorite investigative journalists, you do not want her on your trail, the terrific Jessica Luther. Hi, Jessica.
Hi.
You are up first this week, Jessica. What do we need to know?
Yeah, so Cristiano Ronaldo, the soccer superstar from Portugal who plays for Juventus in Italy, is the third highest paid athlete in the world and possibly the most famous. He is now also under investigation by the Las Vegas Police Department in regard to a 2009 reported sexual assault. A woman by the name of Catherine Mayorga has come forward in a long piece in the German magazine Der Spiegel. She waited until now because back in 2010, Ronaldo settled with her out of court and paid her $375,000 with the stipulation that she never talk about the reported assault again. But she has a new lawyer who is trying to void the settlement on multiple legal grounds. There's a police investigation because she filed a police report and did a rape kit back in 2009, the day after she says he raped her. Ronaldo has denied these allegations, but in their reporting, Der Spiegel says there was an internal document between Ronaldo's lawyers in which Ronaldo admits she said no. There may not be a bigger athlete on this planet. Do you all see this getting any traction?
Well, I think that it should be getting some traction, but given the week that we've had, and also not just the week, but the year, you're looking at Ohio State and Jessica, of course, the work you've done on Baylor and Kavanaugh. I mean, you wonder how you're going to keep your enthusiasm level high, at least to be paid closer attention. I'm going to try to be optimistic and say that this is going to get the sort of traction that it needs and that it's going to, and that people are going to pay attention to it. I wish I were more optimistic than I am. Tyler, what do you think?
I definitely don't have the optimism, mostly because we live in a system here where the powerful is always uplifted, where the powerless are not. This woman has every piece of evidence possible. Mm-hmm. You have sponsors who are kind of backing away from Ronaldo. You have teams who are suspending him and giving him a break. But it should go much further than that, to the point that a woman's furor must be respected, and so should her pain.
Yeah, and you've got Nike that's got a $1 billion endorsement deal with him, by the way. That's $1 billion for one player. And of course, EA Sports has also said that they're monitoring the situation very closely. Jessica, this is the area that you traffic in. When you saw Addison Russell get 40 games for Major League Baseball after his domestic violence situation, is this needle moving at all, in your opinion?
Yeah, I mean, it's moving. It's a, you know, I always describe this as like a giant cruise ship with a teeny tiny rudder, and turning this at all is very difficult. But, you know, for someone like me who studies college football and sexual violence in particular, it wasn't much, but Urban Meyer, he got a little bit of punishment, but it's going to take a long time and a lot of work to get the kind of change that we're hoping for.
Tyler, you're up.
So in the last few weeks, one of the major dissenters in this athletic moment of protest outside of Colin Kaepernick, his former teammate Eric Reed, was recently signed by the Carolina Panthers. Reed is an all-pro level, almost all-world level safety at this point, and was one of the main people who kneeled next to Colin Kaepernick back in August 2016. After Jerry Richardson's reign of misogyny and also sexism and also racism and also everything bad in the world that could be around one owner, him leaving the Panthers last year has opened up a new leadership where owner David Tepper has said that he sides with the protest. That being said, it doesn't feel as if the Panthers have done anything monumental by hiring a dissenter or hiring a protester who was ousted from the league and has a collusion case with the NFL. They've done nothing but hire the right person for the job. But at the same time, it almost feels as if protesters during the Kaepernick era are finding their way back into the league. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I think that, number one, do you get a medal for doing the right thing? Is that what we do here? Jessica, my question for you on this, I'm thinking, is this cynicism in that you finally got a player that you needed when you're the Panthers? Or is it the fact that now that you hire Eric Reed, that collusion lawsuit that he's got currently against the NFL now goes away?
That's a good question. I mean, it does matter that they hired him because he's a good football player. Going back to the discussion we just had, and Tyler brought this up, if we want to talk about the impact of Me Too on sports, the fact that Richardson's not there is because of Sports Illustrated's reporting about his misogyny and racism.
Yeah, that's right.
That's tied into Me Too, right? So we can see a direct impact here. It is hard. You don't want to give them cookies for doing the thing that they should do. I don't know. It's so complicated. I'm really happy, though, that Reed is back.
I think we can mix a piece of actually being happy that somebody who deserves a job got one, and also having skepticism that it took this long for it to happen. The entire NFC South needed
a safety. It never happened in the first place. Why are we waiting until October for this?
Exactly. Eric Reed was not on a preseason roster. Eric Reed was not on a training camp roster. It took multiple men to fall on the gridiron for Eric Reed to even get proposed that he should have a job. The general manager, Marty Herney, said that this is strictly a football decision, and that's when this starts to feel duplicitous. Like, we need to actually speak about it.
Yeah, and he's not being silent. I just want to point out that at his presser,
which was great,
when he was introduced as, his unpacking of U.S. history and oppression in this country should be used in classrooms. And he's being very clear in his messaging, as he has always been.
Yeah, Eric and I talked about this at length during the 2017 season, all year with the 49ers last year. And I remember saying to him, listen, you can't beat the flag, so you're going to have to go head first on shaping your message on what this is all about. Stay on target. If you don't stay on target, then they're going to shape it for you and you're going to lose. So what he did to me was fantastic. I am going to finish things off with football as well. And people hate it when I say it, but sports are filtered through the following lens: white owners, white coaches, white season ticket buyers, white media, and black players. Through this lens, players perform a service for the owners and they entertain the fan base. They have no other rights or concerns. They're paid a ton and they're expected to be grateful. But Earl Thomas, the safety for the Seattle Seahawks, he held out earlier this season for a better contract. And everyone knows the dangers of football, the injury risk, the short window of opportunity, and the fans called him selfish. And he came back, and what happened? He broke his leg. And while being carted off the field, he flipped the middle finger to his own sideline. and some fans burned his jersey. My reaction wasn't to burn his jersey. It was to buy one. Jessica?
But who got your jersey money, though?
Exactly.
The man
and that's
always
the problem.
Wins.
Is there some way to support and also to make sure that the right people are being hurt by this?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And it made me think a lot about this story with J.R. Smith that came up recently in the NBA, and he put a tattoo on his leg, and there's all this discussion about covering it up and sort of this discussion of who owns, I'm putting that in quotes, like who owns these
well,
athletes
it shouldn't
and what
even
do they
be
owe
in quotes,
us?
Jessica, sometimes because yeah. we refer to them as owners.
Right, yes.
We do talk about them as owners. The language of sports is very specific.
Right.
I think the anger that comes at hearing some of these decisions is the fact that we don't really understand the metrics of how capitalism can work, right? You mm-hmm. belong to the people who pay your paychecks, and that's wrong at the basis of it, right? So if the NBA says, J.R. Smith, actually, we do own your skin, mm-hmm. he has one of two choices. Either he says emphatically, no, you don't. I want a brand on my leg. Or he says the money is more important to my kids, which he did say. I'm just going to keep it pushing. And so I think it's powerful that people like Earl Thomas and J.R. Smith are standing up to these corporations that are telling them they're not worth that much, when the reality is, if there's no Le'Veon Bell on the field, as we've seen with the Steelers' offense, the offense doesn't go. The team is bad. Losses accrue. People get fired. And that's just because you wouldn't pay somebody their worth.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been investigative journalist Jessica Luther. Thank you, Jessica.
Thank you.
And SB Nation's Tyler Tynes. Thank you, Tyler.
Thank you.
Here's something you already know. Depending on the market, as much as 90% of sports talk radio listeners are men. Here's something else you also probably know. Women like sports, too. So why don't more women listen to sports talk radio? It's not just because a lot of sports talk radio hosts are jerks. Here's Only a Game's Karen Given.
It's true. I'm a woman, and I don't listen to sports talk radio. I try sometimes. Once I tuned in to find the hosts talking about Fox sportscaster Joe Buck's wife. She used to be a stripper, one of them said. No, no, no. She was a prostitute, the other laughed. For the record, Ann Buck was once an Indianapolis Colts cheerleader. But that doesn't really matter. Her prior profession has nothing to do with her husband's failings as a play-by-play guy. You can't blame me for not tuning in to sports talk radio. If I did, I'd have to listen to what these guys in Boston think about women like sideline reporter Aaron Andrews.
What a seriously. I hate her. What a gutless seriously, go away. Drop dead.
Over the years, I've developed this impression. Sports talk radio must not want me, must not want women. And it turns out, I was right.
Welcome back. You know, there's no doubt a lot of sports has lost its way. And I'm going to tell you, part of the reason is because we've got women giving us directions.
This is from a station in San Francisco.
For some of you, this is going to come across as very misogynistic.
Pro tip. No good can ever come from that disclaimer.
See, here's the thing. I'm willing to share my sandbox as long as you remember you're in my box. I didn't get into yours.
Did he really just say that? Not so long ago, a finance reporter named Jason Nottie was driving down Route 26 heading into Portland, Oregon, when he tuned his radio to sports talk.
After about the second strip club ad, a men's testosterone clinic ad, and a ad for a male-focused attorney, you know, they seem to be targeting somebody here. There is certainly a specific audience that they're going after. Is it me?
Okay, this might seem like it's a no-brainer, and Jason was pretty sure he knew the answer, too. He talked to radio executives and to industry watchers, and he found...
As it turns out, males above the age of 35 are right in the sweet spot of sports radio. Unfortunately, that's me. I fall right into that demographic.
Jason wanted to talk to advertisers, too, but...
The low testosterone clinics did not want to talk to us at all about this.
He found one advertiser more than willing to talk.
This is Rick Jones of Goldberg Jones.
Rick Jones is the managing partner of a law firm that specializes in divorce for men. The firm was founded 23 years ago in Seattle. Back then, most attorneys advertised in the Yellow Pages, but Rick was looking for a more affordable option.
And how long did it take you to find sports talk radio? we actually ran our ads, I believe, for the first time on a Sunday before opening our doors on a Monday.
Oh, please tell me it was like football season or something.
Absolutely. It was mid-January.
Rick says he advertises on some other radio stations, classic rock, that sort of thing. But nothing beats sports talk.
When you are looking at the things that advertisers need to look at, which is the target demographic, the you know, cost per ear, et cetera, and the ratings, it just really made sense to spend money in a sports radio station that has a listenership of in excess of 90% male.
So you're reaching more men, which I guess means that your cost per potential customer is lower, right?
Correct, correct.
In many markets, sports talk radio doesn't even break the top 10 when it comes to ratings, but their listeners are loyal and they're engaged.
Dave from Hillsborough has been calling in for like the last 15 years, and they know Dave's taste. They know what steakhouse Dave likes to eat at. It's interesting to see the lengths they will go to keep both Dave and guys like Jones comfortable.
Just to be crystal clear, it's not the misogyny that keeps advertisers like Rick Jones comfortable. He's not a fan of that kind of thing. This is kind of a weird question, but if suddenly 50% of sports talk listeners were women, would that make it less attractive as an advertising place for you?
You know, the answer is probably yes, but let me explain why, which is if they now had twice as many listeners as they do now, you can fully expect that the amount to advertise at the same level we do, same reach and frequency, would double in cost. Right. And so the only thing that would change is that the cost would double.
Jason Naughty talked to executives at ESPN Radio, and he was surprised by their response.
They seem very cognizant of the fact that this is kind of an antiquated approach, but it works. I think terrestrial radio, they are basically ushering an entire generation along in a velvet coffin. They have the audience they have. They know they're engaged. They know they buy things, and they seem okay with that.
But there's good news if you're a woman who likes sports, because in some ways, terrestrial radio is being replaced by other things, podcasts and YouTube channels and Instagram and Facebook. And in those spaces, women aren't just allowed, they're welcomed. ESPN is investing in podcasts with women behind the mic. I can now watch my friend Andrea Creamer and Hannah Storm calling Thursday night NFL games on Amazon Prime. And this ad played during last winter's college football playoff.
Hey, Anna, do you have those plants?
Yes, but if you have a sec, I just want to...
Okay, so the basic gist of this commercial is that the protagonist, Anna, is an architect. Her boss ignores her ideas and leaves her to explain his mistakes to clients until one day...
What I really wanted to do... Baker Architects, this is Anna Baker.
I'm sure this ad would inspire anyone who's ever had a bad boss. But with that soundtrack, 9 to 5 is practically an anthem of second wave feminism. That ad is targeting me. And it makes sense, because on the TV side of things, as more and more people cut the cord, sports are pretty much the only thing anyone still watches live.
This is why you see so many stations paying exorbitant fees just for rights to broadcast games. You know that's the only way you're going to get that many eyeballs in one place. So yes, they have to be nicer, because they're not just trying to sell a trip to a steakhouse or something like that. They're trying to sell cars. They're trying to sell home loans. They're trying to sell bigger ticket items that more people than just Dave from Hillsborough need.
And this is where the strategy of keeping the advertisers happy gets turned on its head. I talked to Jennifer Storms. She's the chief marketing officer at NBC Sports Group. And she says her main focus isn't to attract advertisers.
We want to make sure that we are always serving our consumers.
But when NBC Sports looked at their audience, their consumers, they discovered that women already made up 46% of NFL fans.
NASCAR, again, another 40 to 50% of the NASCAR fans, they are women. So we're not just wearing pink hats. You know, we're really into it.
Women were already enjoying NBC Sports products, but...
We took a look at it and we said, there's a real opportunity here to serve women even better and even more authentically. And they are such large fans of our sports properties. How do we give them more avenues, more opportunities to express their fandom and engage with us?
Last winter, during the Olympics, NBC launched an initiative called On Her Turf. It's a podcast, Instagram, and YouTube campaign, and it's not designed to attract women to sports. It's designed to reach the women who already enjoy sports and inspire them to take on the world. And in that spirit, I have something to say to this guy.
I'm willing to share my sandbox as long as you remember you're in my box.
That sandbox of yours, it's getting smaller and smaller. But this one over here, the one that I'm playing in, it's got room for everybody.
That's Only a Game's Karen Given. Jason Noddy wrote about sports talk radio advertising for the New York Times. We'll have a link to his story at onlyagame.org. When Arthur Ashe met Jimmy Connors in the 1975 Wimbledon finals, there was much more at stake than just the trophy.
For many years, it was considered the greatest upset in Wimbledon history. I think it's one of the great milestones in modern tennis.
That's just ahead on Only a Game, and remember to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. I'm Howard Bryant. It's been such a long week. I've got things to say. Charlie Pierce always has things to say, and he's here with me now. Hi, you, Charlie.
Hey, Howard. How you doing?
I'm good, but, you know, I got problems. The American League Division Series is underway at Fenway Park. As we know, we've got Red Sox, we've got Yankees. But to me, there's already been two losers, the A's and their fans, because baseball's perennially stupid one-game playoff. You got a team that won 97 games already home. And I just don't like this. I've been complaining about this for years. I think that after 162 games, you deserve a playoff series at least. What do you think about this?
Actually, I mean, I hate to say it, but I love one and done. I love one and done.
Even after 162?
Yeah, even after 162, I love one and done. I mean, if I had a rooting interest in it, then maybe I wouldn't like it very much. But in terms of being a, you know, just a fan of the game, I love the pressure of one and done. I really do. I mean, I understand that baseball's different because of the length of the season and so forth, but win or go home is just the greatest thing in all of sports. So I'm a fan of them, to be honest with you.
I've got two issues with it. One, this is not the NCAA tournament. That's one of the things that bothers me. The other thing that bothers me about this is we don't penalize, in any other sport, we don't penalize teams for not coming in first place. In baseball, if you don't win the division, they make you play one game. It would be as if in basketball, if you didn't win the Atlantic Division, you got to play a play-in game for the right to play the eight seed. I just think it's weird in baseball. I understand why they're doing it. But I just think it really robs you, especially if you're the A's. You had a great, great season, and now you're done after one afternoon in Yankee Stadium.
Well, yeah, but you know what? I don't care. I enjoy when I'm done. My sympathies to Oakland and its fans, but I don't care.
how about two and done, Charlie? We got the postscript on the Chicago Cubs. You've got a tiebreaker against the Brewers, which I'm sure you loved watching at Wrigley. And the Brewers win that. Then the Cubs have to play the next day, the one-game playoff, which I hate, against the Rockies. They lose that in 13 innings. Weird season. On Sunday, they started the day with the best record in the National League. 48 hours later, after two games at home, they're finished.
Yeah, I mean, win a home game, though. You know, I mean, you know, win.
score more than a run.
Exactly right. You know, they've been a weird team all year, though.
Yeah.
You know, they went through these spells of what looked like apathy to me.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, one of those hit at the wrong time.
Well, absolutely. They scored one run or fewer 40 times this year. And still won 95 games, so I guess they should get a medal for that.
Yeah, outside of the Red Sox winning 108 games with that bullpen, that stat on the Cubs is the most inexplicable thing of the year.
It's incredible. The only team to score one run or fewer more times than the Cubs was the Orioles, and they lost 115 games. So winning so winning 95 with that sort of anemic offense is doing something. There was news this week. In a novel move, Tennis Channel will begin showing, wait for it, tennis. More specifically, the Women's Tennis Tour, which went out on its own in a disastrous venture with BN Sports. For the last 2 years, women's tennis outside of the Grand Slams has been virtually invisible. Meanwhile, for the past 5 years, many Los Angeles Dodgers fans haven't been able to watch the games in their market because some cable networks won't carry Sportsnet LA. With the combination of cord cutting and contempt, do you think people are realizing that life goes on? Or if you're just a diehard sports fan, do you just wait forever until these corporations figure it out?
Yeah, I think both are true. But I also think there is another phenomenon going on, and that is the phenomenon of finding a way to be a fan without attending games and without necessarily watching on television. I mean, you always could be a fan through betting, but now you could be a fan through fantasy sports. You can be a fan through memorabilia. There are all kinds of ways to do it. You can be a fan through media nostalgia.
Yep.
What this thing with the women's tennis thing reminds me most of is the phenomenally disastrous decision that the NHL made years ago to get off ESPN and onto Sports Channel.
Oh, that's right. Or when they went to, but then they go to Spike TV for the playoffs. Remember that?
They went to Spike TV for the playoffs. Before that, they went to Sports Channel. You know, they were ESPN's only professional league.
Yep, that's right.
At the time. And ESPN did them up. You know, they did them up ESPN. They did what ESPN does, which is to hype them to the moon. And then they moved on to Sports Channel. That's what this reminds me most of.
No, they made a big mistake. And I think the good news is, at least if you're a fan of WTA tennis, and I am, because I watch the women as much as I watch the men, I'm happy that they're back. I can actually watch them for the season. And, you know, finally, Charlie, you know, no show would be complete without at least some discussion of the Cleveland Browns. But here's a story about a different team. A bar in Iowa has a locked cooler full of Budweiser, not Bud Light, but Budweiser, that it will open when the Cornhuskers win its first football game of the season. Great idea, right?
Yeah, I don't understand why a bar in Iowa is doing this, but okay. They're just making fun of the Huskers. That cooler is likely going to stay closed for at least another week.
But here's my question. What happened to Nebraska football? If you are of a certain generation...
My late mother-in-law was from Seward, Nebraska. Her brother and her father and her grandfather all played football for Nebraska. I mean, I think they've been crippled, I think, by conference realignment and by the fact that the whole nature of college football has changed. The thing about those Nebraska teams was, outside of people like Johnny Rogers and Tommy Frazier, they were big goons. They would beat you to death.
Yep.
Over the up and down the field. The game's changed to very big people who are really fast, and I don't think Nebraska's ever really caught up on that.
Yeah, we've come a long way since Tom Rathman and Roger Craig, huh?
There you go.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time, and he joins us each week on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Howard.
You know the saying, game recognize game? Whether it's Aaron Rodgers and Tom Brady, LeBron James and Kevin Durant, greatness knows it when it sees it. It's like a spider sense. The same goes for the Only a Game podcast. We think you're great, and we're pretty good too. So recognize our game by subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And while you're there, leave us a review. You're helping listeners find our show and helping us raise our game. Jimmy Connors may be America's greatest tennis player. Arthur Ashe may be its most influential. They couldn't stand each other.
Ashe really disliked anyone who had a kind of braggadocio, anyone who preened himself in the way that Connors did.
That's University of South Florida professor and historian Raymond Arsenault.
He just wasn't one to attack anyone. He always gave everybody the benefit of the doubt. But as a member of his family told me once, the only person that he really didn't like on the tour was Jimmy Connors.
One was brilliant but craven, the other a quiet revolutionary with a powerful sense of patriotism. Here's Only a Game's Gary Wallach on Arthur Ashe's clash with his greatest nemesis, one that unfolded on and off the court.
The quarrel between Jimmy Connors and Arthur Ashe probably began with the Davis Cup, the annual international team tennis event that dates back to 1900. According to Raymond Arsenault, their attitudes towards playing on the U.S. team were diametrically opposed.
I think Ashe, it meant a tremendous amount to him because it affirmed his notion of self-worth, that he was a citizen, a proud citizen, and that he was respected enough to represent his nation.
Ashe was the first African-American to represent the U.S. in Davis Cup competition. He had played on the U.S. team in 8 different years by the time Jimmy Connors was dominating men's tennis in the mid-70s. But Connors refused to join the team. This irritated Ashe.
He could never understand why Connors didn't share any of that sentiment, that it didn't mean anything to him. If he didn't make money out of it, he didn't seem to want to do it.
In June of 1974, Arthur Ashe was elected president of the Association of Tennis Professionals, a new governing body created to represent the interests of male tennis players.
Well, there had never been anything remotely like a tennis players union, and the national federations around the world and tennis promoters were really making all of the decisions, and the players felt that they were left out, that they needed a voice.
Connors refused to join the ATP. Instead, he kept playing as a member of World Team Tennis, or WTT. In 1974, WTT filed a $10 million lawsuit against ATP executives and a major sponsor of the European Grand Slam events for barring WTT players. Just hours before Ashe's election as president of the ATP, Connors and his agent joined that lawsuit. Ashe was infuriated, so he wrote a letter
to the members of the ATP in which he described Connors as brash, arrogant, and unpatriotic.
The letter became public. On June 21, 1975, just 2 days before Wimbledon's first round began, Connors and his agent filed another lawsuit. This time, it was for libel, and it named Ashe and his letter specifically. Connors and his agent sought $3 million in damages. Ashe was fighting in and on more than one court.
Wimbledon was really special to him.
The 32-year-old Ashe had dreamed of winning Wimbledon since he was a young kid.
And I think he pretty much knew this was his last chance.
But Ashe also knew that might be wishful thinking. Jimmy Connors, 9 years his junior, had won the 1974 Australian and U.S. Opens and was the reigning Wimbledon champ. He started the 1975 season by winning 9 of the tournaments he entered.
He dominated in a way that few players have ever dominated. He was thought to be unbeatable, invincible, really.
Ashe knew there'd be a good chance he'd have to go through Connors to capture a Wimbledon title. In mid-June of 1975, Ashe and Connors competed at the Nottingham Open, a pre-Wimbledon warm-up tournament. Both lost in the quarterfinals. In a post-tournament press conference, Connors said that he had been just a little bit off his game.
But in the future, he would just crush his opponents. And to be honest, almost all of the journalists covering Wimbledon thought he was correct. But that statement just stuck in Arthur's craw.
Ashe kept his anger to himself, for a little while anyway.
He filed it away.
When play at Wimbledon got underway, Arthur Ashe and Jimmy Connors were in opposite brackets. They breezed by their opponents. Connors didn't lose a single set. Ashe dispatched Tony Roach in the semis on July 3rd and sat in the stands to watch Connors play Roscoe Tanner.
Roscoe Tanner had the fastest serve in tennis. And every time he would hit these scorching serves or ground strokes, Connors would hit it back 10 miles an hour faster.
Advantage, Connors.
When Arthur saw this, he thought, oh, wow. If Roscoe can't out-hit him, then really no one could.
Connors defeated Tanner in straight sets. But while watching them, Ashe got an idea. What if he didn't try to out-hit Connors?
Don't give him any pace. Just constantly take it off chip and lob, just drive him crazy, hit low to his forehand volley, and that might conceivably work.
On the morning of July 5th, 1975, Jimmy Connors was the overwhelming favorite to defeat Arthur Ashe. When they took center court, Connors' gamesmanship was obvious.
He had an Italian designer's outfit on.
But Ashe made a fashion statement of his own.
Arthur is wearing the Davis Cup sweatshirt, blue with red letters saying USA. And it was a kind of reminder that Connors had let his country down and let his fellow players down. I mean, that wasn't like Arthur to play those kind of mind games, but this may have been one of the times when he did.
It was also unlike Ashe to play a strictly chip and lob game.
He killed him with kindness, with the slow ball, with the spins.
Love 15.
And I wonder if Connors lost his head a bit there. I think the Ashe ball would have floated out.
Don't give him any pace, and you'll drive him crazy.
Game.
I mean, he won the first set 6-1. Connors wasn't even in it. And Connors hardly won a point in the second set. The crowd is just stunned. No one thought this was remotely possible.
Down 2-0, Connors came back to win the third.
Well, here goes. Connors is going to come back, and he's going to win 3 straight sets. This fantasy of ashes is going to be over.
In the fourth set, it looked like Connors would even the match at two sets apiece. But Ash abandoned the chip and lob and reverted to his usual array of topspin backhands and well-placed forehands to build a 5-4 lead in the fourth set.
40-15.
So, two championship points for Arthur Ashe.
That's it! And he's done it. He really has done it.
He turned to the crowd, and before shaking Connor's hand, he raised his right arm and made a fist. Some interpreters thought that he was doing a Black Power salute. He said no, that he had no intention of that. But this was a moment, I think, it would have meant so much to him that he impulsively raised his arm.
Ash had fulfilled his lifelong dream. In doing so, he had become the first Black man to win a Wimbledon singles title. After the match, Ash, still angry at Connor's lawsuits, stepped out of character again and suggested that his opponent had choked.
That just drove Connors crazy when he heard that. Billie Jean King, you know, she won Wimbledon in 75, and by tradition, the two singles winners danced the first dance at the Wimbledon ball. Jimmy Connors, he said he'd come only if he could have the first dance, meaning he could be treated like the winner. And when he knew he couldn't be, he didn't show up.
2 days after the Wimbledon final, Ash reverted to his usual sportsmanlike self. He described Connors as a nice guy and the best tennis player in the world. A few days after that, Connors dropped the suit against Ash.
And so I think it's probably a credit to Jimmy Connors that he did have enough common sense and decency to drop the suit.
A lot was riding on the 1975 Wimbledon men's final. The clash of personalities, the right of players to represent themselves, the right of governing bodies to determine who can play in what tournaments. But Arthur Ashe raised his game accordingly.
I think that he realized he was on the biggest stage in tennis. He felt he was representing the ATP and that Connors was a threat to them. He wanted to make a moral statement as well as win the tournament. For many years, it was considered the greatest upset in Wimbledon history. I think it's one of the great milestones in modern tennis.
Arthur Ashe is still the only Black Wimbledon men's singles champion.
That's Only a Game's Gary Wallach. Raymond Arsenault's new book is Arthur Ashe, A Life. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Matthew Stock. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. We had help this week from Max Liebman. Our senior producer is Karen Given. Our final word comes from Arthur Ashe biographer Raymond Arsenault, who says that people were surprised when Ashe said that his 1975 Wimbledon triumph was not his greatest win.
He didn't see it as important as winning the Davis Cup in 1968.
I'm Howard Bryant. Only a Game returns next week. Thank you for listening.